Hello, everybody. Many of you have said morning, Josh. My name's Josh. If we haven't met before, it's my joy to be one of the ministers here at church. And it's a rough reading that we've just started with this morning. You've all heard it read, and so by way of preface, I thought it's worth saying if this is something that resonates with you, some hurt you've experienced, like this at the hands of wicked people, just know that you're not alone. Don't keep that hurt to yourself bottled up, but come and speak with someone. Myself, David, Ken, we are here for you. We're here to hear you. Nothing you say will be a surprise. We know what it's like in the world that is marked by sin and wickedness. And if we don't have the ability to help, we know where to find you the right help. So don't keep that to yourself. But in light of that, let me just pray as we begin. Heavenly Father, we do acknowledge the brokenness of our world that's seen so clearly in our story from 2 Samuel this morning. We just acknowledge that many of us, many of the people we know, have been hurt by the wickedness of men. We just ask that as we look at this story, this sad story of wickedness, that you still be growing us, you still be teaching us, and that through hardship we might learn, we might grow, and that this morning we might hear the lessons you have prepared for us to hear. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. It is a wicked story, a story of like father, like son, isn't it? If you were here last week, you no doubt hear the way it resonates between the past and the present here now. And so I was just thinking this like father, like son story. There's about 1,000 research papers in every institution that talks about this question of nature and nurture and where do these wicked things come from. One Bible teacher from the 1700s, Matthew Henry was his name, he says it like this: godly parents have often been afflicted with wicked children. Grace does not flow in the blood, but corruption does. Corruption does. My mum tells a story about how people are born sinful. Illustration used of my brother, not me, of course. But she recalls he's at preschool. He hasn't started school yet. He's 3 years older than me. And so I was a newborn, a little toddler. And so I was at home and he was off at preschool. And mum has come to pick him up from preschool this one day and walked in and seen him across the playground. And he's looked at this girl playing with this toy. And he's paused and looked. He's grabbed the toy and, being taller than her, has just lifted it up out of her reach and watched her jump and reach for her toy while he smirks at the dilemma he's caused. And she thought, why is he doing that? I didn't teach him to do that. Why? But you see, corruption is just our nature. As people, sin is just our nature. We enjoy indulging in sin, even when it's at the expense of other people. That's what it means to be human. And so we see profoundly the human experience of sin in these verses. We see the nature of mankind that is sinful and broken. We see the harm that comes when people indulge in sin. This section we've read the first half of chapter 13, but this morning we want to cover 13 and 14. And really, this is kind of part B of what Ken started with last week. And so from chapter 11 with David and Bathsheba all the way to the end of chapter 14 now is about a decade in the history of Israel. And so let me just recap the story, because there's a few key things that we need to keep in mind from last week as we head into chapter 13 and beyond into chapter 14. So the story goes, as we've already heard, David's on his roof, and as he's on his roof, he sees Bathsheba bathing. He saw, and he wanted, and he took. He's brought Bathsheba to himself and he slept with her. He's got her pregnant, and knowing that she's pregnant now, and it couldn't be anyone else's because her husband's off at war, well, so begins his cover-up. He brings Uriah back in an attempt to cover this up. As Uriah comes back, he wants Uriah to then sleep with his wife so that people will assume it's just his son, or his child rather. But at that point, okay, Uriah has too much integrity. He's saying, I'm not going to come home and sleep in my bed with my wife while the men are at war. He's loyal to his men and ironically loyal to David at this point. And so what happens? He doesn't sleep with her. David gets him drunk, and again, it doesn't work out. And so the only thing David can do to cover up his sin is to have Uriah murdered. He sends him back to the battlefield, the most fierce part of fighting, has all the other men withdraw so that Uriah is struck down dead. So at this point, David indulged in lust and murder. Now, you know, the story of 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel being one narrative, we see this rise of Saul and this decline of Saul. We've seen these last few chapters of 2 Samuel, the rise of David, but all of a sudden, last week, well, so began the decline of David. He wasn't the king that we were expecting him to be. I mean, God said to him in 2 Samuel 7, your house and kingdom will endure before me forever, and your throne will be established forever. We've got high hopes for Israel under the rule of their new king David. But all of a sudden, we're disillusioned, aren't we? We see David for who he is. We're disappointed, disgusted. So after hearing of David's failings, he's confronted by the prophet, and these are the verses we need to keep in mind in particular as we consider this week. In chapter 12, verse 10, it says, God says to him through Nathan, now, therefore the sword will never depart from your house, because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own. Verse 11, out of your house I'm going to bring calamity. Because of David's sin, his house is going to be destroyed. It's going to be marked by destruction and war and calamity. That's what it means to be of the house of David now. And so then we turn over to chapter 13 and enter David's children. There's a few key characters we're going to meet, and let me just talk through them so we can get a bit of a picture. For me, sometimes, I don't know about you, but when we see these funny Hebrew names and when we hear the way the Bible describes so-and-so was son of so-and-so and so-and-so was son of so-and-so, it gets a bit disjointed in my mind. So I've put together a visual aid. It's pretty high-tech. David. Okay? So we see David. He's the king. And now we're going to unpack in these chapters the life of his children. So we have Amnon. Amnon is David's eldest son. He's the heir apparent. And we might be expecting Amnon to be the one who's going to continue David's dynasty and continue David's throne. As we've seen, God's promise this is going to go on forever. So he's kind of the hope for the next great king of Israel. But this will prove not to be the case. We see another son of David. This son's name is Absalom. This son, he's the second eldest surviving son of David. He's second in line to the throne at this point. And now both these characters are David's sons, but they have different mothers, so they're half-brothers. Okay? That's what's in the family tree. We see a woman. We see Tamar. Now, Tamar is said to be the sister of Absalom, so now a half-sister of Amnon, and the brother from the same mother on this side of David's family. Is it this side? This side on your screen. Mine's back to front. And so we see these three children of David. We see Amnon, we see Absalom, and we see Tamar. And that's kind of how they work through the two different wives, the two different mothers. And we see one more character. He's more of a minor character in the story, but important to keep in mind of what unfolds in the rest of the story. And so that fellow's name is Jonadab. So we meet Jonadab, who is the son of David's brother, Shimeah. So he's David's nephew, and he's Absalom and Amnon and Tamar's cousin here. And so this, in verse 3, we see him as this shrewd man, wise in the sense that he's crafty. He always has a plan. And so that's my high-tech visual aid to the family tree. I looked for one online, but they just had so much stuff and it would just be lost. So this is super helpful, I hope. So as the story goes, we hear about David's failings. We hear that there's going to be calamity on his house because of what's happened. And then we turn to chapter 13 and we see some of that unfold. We see this character named Amnon. He becomes obsessed with Tamar. So obsessed, he makes himself sick. In his mind, it's as lovesick, but no, that's not what it is at all. Because she was a virgin, it seemed impossible for him to do anything to her. You know, but when we hear that, we might start to think, what is it that he might want to do to her? And to Jonadab, this cousin, this shrewd, crafty cousin, and he questions, Amnon, why are you always seeming so ill? Why are you haggard morning after morning? You're the heir of the king. What could possibly be wrong with you? Why are you looking so wretched? Amnon tells him. Well, he says he's fallen for his sister. He's in love with her, he says. And so, Jonadab comes up with a plan for Amnon. How can we get you what you want, he thinks. He comes up with this crafty plan that if he was to fake sick, the king would come to see his sick heir, and at that point he can say, oh, send my sister to make me some bread in my presence, then I can eat it, and that would help somehow. And so, okay, seems like a good plan. He goes along with it. Disappointingly, his plan goes off without a hitch. He fakes sick. David comes and he says, David, do this, send Tamar to make the bread. And David, off he skips to his beck and call and goes to Tamar and sends Tamar to go and to make the bread as per his instructions. And Tamar comes. She makes the bread. And at that point, he sends the servants away. He says to her, come into my bedroom. He grabs her. He says, come to bed with me, my sister. 5 times already we've heard her referred to as the sister, but all of a sudden now it has these erotic overtones, doesn't it? You can hear the cry in her voice, can't you? No, my brother, don't force me. Such a thing shouldn't be done in Israel. Think about the effects on me. Think about the effects on you, she says, as she pleads for him not to take this action. She tries to throw out some logic. You know, it's okay, the king will let us be married. It's fine. But no, fueled by lust and desire, just like his father, he takes what isn't his to take. Obviously, the law said they couldn't be married, but she's desperate. She can't bear what's going to happen to her. At that point, the language is as brutal and brief as the act itself. But he refused to listen to her. And, since he was stronger than she, he raped her. The very next moment, we see, suddenly Amnon discovers to his own trouble and loss, and to her trouble and loss, what has actually happened. You see, he was never feeling love. He was feeling lust. And now that he's seen and taken, that lust turns to hatred. Maybe he's realized the error in what he's done. But either way, taking what wasn't his to take doesn't leave him feeling fulfilled and loved. No. But when we indulge in sin, it corrupts our character. It turns him to hatred. It turns him to hatred. More than that, he casts her out. The victim now is cast out as if she had done something wrong. He bolts the door behind her as she's weeping, as she leaves, she's pleading. You know, the act's already done. It's better now if you were not to send me away, but we just move on together. No, not even that logic is making any sense to Amnon. No. So he sends her away. He bolts the door behind her. And at this point, Absalom clues on to what's been going on. He clues on to what's happened to his sister. No doubt her weeping and her tears, the way she's dressed. He sees something's gone wrong. And I think it speaks volume to the character of Amnon that Absalom's question is, has Amnon done this? Has he been with you? He's quick to make that accusation. What does he say? He tries to reassure her. Don't take this to heart. He's not belittling the crime that has happened to her. But in this context, as he says, don't take this to heart, well, he's saying, my sister, don't worry, I will take care of it. He is going to take this matter into his own hands. That's what we see here. So he's reassuring her. he is going to be the one to take care of them. At that point, we get to the end of our reading. David hears about it. David is furious in verse 21. Absalom does not speak to Amnon because of the way he has disgraced his sister. She goes and lives with Absalom, and that's the last we hear about her in the biblical narrative. And so some 2 years later, as we continue on, he's going to take matter into his own hands. These 2 years later, we see it's come time for the sheep shearing festival, a great celebration in the life of Israel. And so Absalom, well, he hatches a plan. He invites all the brothers, all the king's sons and the king to come and celebrate the sheep shearing festival. See, he had a plan here. You see, David responds as the king to Absalom, "No, we couldn't all possibly come to this festival. It would be too much. It would be a burden on you." I mean, I'm sure we've all felt at some point the burden of having the whole family over for Christmas, the whole family over for that birthday party. Hospitality can sometimes be a chore. And so David said, "No, it would be a burden to you." And I think Absalom was expecting him to respond this way. It was part of the manipulation. And so Absalom says, "Okay, fine, we'll just send Amnon in your stead. You're the king, he's the heir of the king. It makes sense to send him." David hesitates. You know, David knows what's happened. David knows what Amnon's done, and he knows the anger that is enraged in Absalom. And so what does he do? Well, he hesitates, but obviously a case has been made that he can't refuse. And so Amnon and some of the other brothers, off they go to the harvest, to the sheep shearing festival, sorry. And at that point, Absalom talks to his men, and he instructs them, "When I give you the order, you are to kill Amnon. When I give you the order." It's almost a calm, collected way as you read the text. The servants seem unsure, but he encourages them to be bold and to be sure in your action of murder, because you're following my commands. This is all my plan. He says, he's calm, collected. It's organized, it's premeditated murder. That's what we see from Absalom. And so, as Amnon is drunk and happy at the celebration, he gives the order, and his men kill Amnon. At that point, seeing the king's heir, the son of the king, murdered, well, obviously all the other sons, they flee, they jump on their horses and run as fast as they can, because who knows who is next? Absalom had killed Amnon. He had achieved his goal of vengeance in his calm, collected, premeditated way. It's all part of the manipulation. Jonadab, this character, he's back again. Obviously, he knew something of Absalom's plan, because he's straight to the king to tell the king about how all the sons have been dead. He blows the story out of proportion and tells tall tales. Maybe it's part of his manipulation game, because this is the second heinous crime he's been caught up with. It was his plot in chapter 13 with the rape of Tamar, and now he's somehow involved in this murder. Do you think David's going to be happy with this? Does he want David to know his involvement in these heinous crimes under David's watch? No, he is the master manipulator. He's no wise man. He's no friend. And so David originally believes his foolishness, but eventually the truth filters down to him. And at that point, Absalom flees. He leaves David's jurisdiction and he goes to the land of Geshur, which is kind of his grandfather's area, which is outside of the jurisdiction of David. So he's safe, free, in exile at this point after committing this murder. And that takes us to chapter 14, where we see three more crafty schemes from three characters. We see this other fellow, Joab, we see David, and we see Absalom. All three of them hatch a scheme. As the story goes in chapter 14, Joab's obviously noticed this three-year separation. This is another 3 years after. He's been in exile 3 years, so the story through the decade is continuing. And he thinks, okay, well, this is the new heir of the king. And now he's off in exile. Something's gone wrong. The kingdom is torn. And we read in chapter 14 as well that Absalom is handsome and popular and people love him. And so what was happening when the king now is there with his heir, who people like, estranged in a foreign land, Well, obviously, there's going to be implications for the kingdom. And so Joab comes up with his own plan. He finds this wise woman who's from a town some 15 kilometers outside of Jerusalem and gets her on board with his plot. He gives her the words to say that he might manipulate David, that he might scheme his own way to bring some sort of reconciliation between them and restore power in the kingdom. And so she comes, she approaches the throne, she comes to the king, but she dresses as a widow, mourning the loss of her husband, pleading for the king's help. She tells a tall tale of her sons, and they had this fight, and one's killed the other, echoes these Cain and Abel, these brotherly conflict stories we've heard already. And she questions the king what's to do, and the king says, "Don't worry, I'll solve it," and she expects his answer from Joab, and Joab tells her the things to say. And so she talks around for 20-odd verses here, and we see in the end she actually forces the king to swear by God that, you know, this son who committed this murder, this manslaughter, wouldn't be punished. And so at that point, bold as she is to speak to the king in this way, says, "Aha, you are a hypocrite." A paraphrase. She points out the fact that he was willing to swear by God that her son, for his actions, wouldn't be harmed, yet the king's own son, the king's own heir, has been for the last 3 years off exile to a different land. Isn't that hypocritical? Again, another point where David told a parable or a story that has exposed his failings. And so realizing that he's being manipulated, he realizing that he's wrong in his actions, David hatches his own scheme. Okay, you're probably right. You know, I should probably bring him back into the kingdom. But David thinks, you know what? Okay, I'll bring him back to the kingdom, but I've got something different in store. I'm not going to bring him back into the kingdom, into my home. No, instead, he can come back into Jerusalem but live another place, you know, a little way off. That way, David doesn't have to see him. He doesn't have to enter the king's presence. And so what David's done in his scheme now is he's profoundly abdicated leadership. Because there's two options David had should he be a leader with integrity. He can welcome the son in as the son who is now forgiven for his crime as his heir. That's one option. Or he could follow what the law says, and that is the consequence for Absalom's deliberate premeditated murder is his own execution. That's what the law requires. And so they were the two options for David. And what does he do? He sweeps it under the rug. He says, "Oh, you know, just go live over there. I don't want to deal with this right now." That was David's scheme. He realizing that he's been out schemed, he comes up with his own plan to avoid dealing with the issue. But Absalom, now back in Jerusalem after all these years and after all this family turmoil, he has a little scheme of his own. You see, there's the start of a profound civil war. Absalom, now living back in Jerusalem, he says to Joab, "What's even the point? Why am I here?" Well, first he called Joab to come talk to him several times and ends up setting Joab's land on fire so Joab will finally come and have the conversation. And he says, "What's going on? Why am I here? I might as well be back in Geshur with my granddad, because you know what? It doesn't even matter that I'm here." Joab, "Okay, sure." He says, I'm gonna go see the king." Absalom says, "I'm going to go see the king, David, and whatever happens, let it happen." He goes, he comes to the king like a servant, like one of the other citizens, and bows before the king, and the king kisses him. Not a kiss of welcoming home the lost son, but a kiss on the ring of that, you know, royal duty. He's just like any other citizen. And at that point, Absalom's scheme has worked out, because there appears to be this reconciliation, but really it just lays the groundwork for what we're going to see in the coming chapters of this civil war that breaks out in David's family, David's kingdom, in God's kingdom. But that's for next week. So that's our story as it goes from chapter 11 with that run-up into 13 or 14 and beyond. The question remains, though, what do we do with a story like What can we learn from these heinous crimes? What can we learn from this 10-year history of David's family unraveling? Well, I think there's a couple key things we can take notice of. The first thing is a warning as we look at their character. You see, those two sons, Amnon and Absalom, what we see is a profound pattern in their actions of desire, sin, and consequence. That pattern of desire, sin, and consequence is for both of them. You see, Amnon, he desired Tamar. He wanted, he lusted after her. He desired, he sinned. He didn't flee from his desire, but he indulged. He took her for himself. And there were consequences. Not only was the consequence that, you know, his half-brother murdered him for it, but there were real consequences in the moment. He realized the deceitfulness of sin. What happens when he indulges in sin? His character is fueled by hate, not love. It ruins him. Sin ruins our character. So in Amnon, we see this pattern of desire, sin, and consequence. Absalom's the same. We see a pattern of desire, sin, and consequence. Absalom, we might be, you know, fooled into thinking, well, he was just wanting justice. He was just wanting justice. But you know what? Absalom's desire wasn't justice. Absalom's desire was vengeance. And there is a difference there. Because the text tells us that he was fueled by anger and hatred for his brother. He wasn't fueled by a desire for justice. He was fueled by anger and hatred. So he has this desire for vengeance from this ungodly place of hatred and anger. What does he do? He sins. He indulges in that desire by murdering his brother. And what are the consequences? Well, the consequences are clear in that he's left in exile. He's left in an estranged land. The consequences of the turmoil in his family are so obvious and become more obvious as we see the story unfold. There's this pattern of desire, sin, and consequence, and it's no surprise that it's just the same pattern we saw last week, where David desired Bathsheba. He sinned, and there were consequences. We read those at the start, in chapter 12, and 10, and 11. It's the same pattern. It's rinse and repeat. It goes round and round and round. That is what it is to be a human, to be fueled by desire and sin. And so I wonder, what are our desires? What are our sins? What are the consequences we feel because of that? Maybe we don't feel the bitterness of rape and murder in our desires, in the consequences of our sin. Maybe our sins are those more acceptable sins. Maybe we're not fueled by lust and murder in the same way in this story. Maybe it is just simple anger or frustration, discontentness, unkindness. Maybe we fail to be thankful. Maybe we're prideful. Maybe we're selfish. Maybe we lack the self-control God expects of us. You see, we are just as sinful as those two. Jesus tells us in Matthew 5 that if we lust in our heart, and if we hate in our heart, well, we might as well have done the action. The people we need to identify with in this story, sadly, is Amnon and Absalom. We're just like them. We are sinful people that are fueled by desire, that indulge and that feel the consequence of that sin. And so that's where we stand. But what do we do with that? What's the practical thing that we can take away and remember so that we don't end up like these guys? Well, I don't know if you noticed, but as we read the story and as I read it, and maybe read it at home, you might notice, God isn't really on display in this story. God just falls off the radar completely. It's not a deliberate disregard of God, but it's almost an indifference. You know, in the heat of their desire, their sin, and the consequence, no one consults God. Did you notice that? These are supposed to be the leaders of God's people, yet Amnon, when he feels this desire inside of him, does he talk to God and ask for God to provide a way out of his desire? No, he doesn't. When he does the wrong thing, his heart is spurred on with hatred, does he seek God's forgiveness? No. When he's feeling the consequences and the turmoil in their family, do they ask God to provide a way for reconciliation? No, God doesn't appear in the story at all. As Absalom takes his vengeance, does he consider that justice is God's, as God says? No, he takes justice into his own hands. Surely God couldn't work it out. I need to solve this problem. Did you notice that? God has fallen off the table altogether. God has fallen off the table altogether. So my encouragement is that we don't fall into that trap. Don't get into the habit of going along, living our own lives our own way, and just forgetting God, because that's where it started for them. It started just by forgetting God. Just one action, one thought, one deed where they didn't consult God. Before you know it, it snowballs down to their living these lives in disregard to what God had expected and commanded of them. And so my encouragement is that we need to build each other up. We as God's people, the body, the church, need to be accountable to each other. We need to spur one another on towards love and good deeds. We need to encourage each other to flee from our selfish desires, free from indulging in our sinful desires. We need to encourage and push each other. We need to encourage and rebuke each other when we see our brothers and sisters go astray. We need to encourage each other and work together at digging so deep into the text that every action and every desire we have, we see through the lens God has given us in the gospel. That is what we need to hear from this. We can't fall into the pattern that they fell into because they forgot about God. Friends, we cannot forget. You see, when I told you the story about my brother, he didn't need to learn to be cruel. We don't need to learn to sin, but we need to learn godliness. We need to train in godliness, and we need to be in that journey together, partnering as God's people, building each other up. At this point in 2 Samuel, we've seen the story unfold, and you stop and take stock. What's going on here? What's happened to God's kingdom? What's happened to God's people? How can God bring his chosen forever king from this family? From this family marked by lust and rape and murder. That is the family from which God is going to bring his king? We've seen the failures of Saul, David, and now David's sons and heirs. And there's more civil war to come. You see, at every moment as we read this story, we are reminded of the sinful nature of the world. We cannot hope for a king from this world, because that is what happens when we look for hope in this world. That is what the world looks like. Instead, we need to look for a king. We need to look for hope beyond our world. We need to look to the God who sends his perfect king to bring us perfect forgiveness in the midst of our imperfect.